This is Matt Wells at UN News. Although it's situated far from the UN's headquarters in New York, the International Court of Justice, based in The Hague in the Netherlands, is as integral a part of the United Nations as the Security Council or General Assembly. Conor Lennon from UN News caught up with Philippe Gauthier, the newly appointed Registrar of the ICJ and former Registrar of the International Tribunal for the Law of the Sea, during a visit to headquarters in October. He started by asking Mr. Gauthier to explain the crucial role the ICJ plays on the world stage.
The court plays a crucial role in fulfilling one of the major tasks of the UN Charter, that means the maintenance of peace and security. And you know that whenever there are disputes between states, there is a prohibition of the use of force as a means to settle disputes. These states would need to put any dispute to a court, an international court, which could be adjudicate and give a solution to the dispute. And that's exactly the role of the court. And I would say it's the only permanent and worldwide court which exists. And it's a principal judicial organ of the UN. I insist on the term judicial organ because it's away from headquarters. This, it's not so well known. It's in The Hague, that's the seat. But it's part of the United Nations.
So as essential as the General Assembly or the Security Council?
And ECOSOC.
Yeah,
exactly. And the competence is twofold. First is to settle disputes, to adjudicate disputes between states, and it renders binding judgment, which have to be complied by the states. And the other side is that there is a possibility to give advisory opinions, which are essentially not binding, but which have some authoritative force.
And so with regards to the binding judgments, do states always adhere to those judgments, or are there cases where they don't? And if they don't, what happens next?
Yeah, that's the classical question in international law. There is no really enforcement mechanism except with the adherence of the Security Council. And there is a possibility there, but I would not address that. I would say any judgment of the court is final, binding, has to be complied with. There is no appellate body somewhere. And if you look at practice, I would say the record is quite good. Doesn't mean that's perfect. In life, nothing is perfect. But we may be proud of the record.
There's no appeal. What do you think about that fact, the fact that basically there's no recourse, the judgment is final and that's it?
I would say, but that's a personal view, because that's the nature of international law, that when there is a final judgment, and by a permanent court or as the ICJ, it's in the statute. And that's you need an end point at a certain time. I mean, you cannot constantly lodge appeals. And it's true that the court is composed also of 15 judges, coming from different backgrounds, elected at the same time, or I would say more or less at the same time, by the Security Council and the General Assembly. There is some legitimacy, and it shows that the system was well designed. And I would add that it functions well. I mean, if you want to look at a success story for the time being, you need to be humble. But if you look at the success story when it comes to multilateralism, look at the ICJ. I mean, up until and from 46 until today, there were 177 cases filed, which is quite a record. And for the time being, 16 cases are pending. And I would say more than 50% of the cases brought before the court have been brought during the past 30 years. This, it means really that states have confidence into this mechanism. It means also that the mechanism is useful. And whenever there is a court like the ICJ, it is used. And I would like to mention also that it's not so easy to bring a case to a court like the ICJ, because it's based on consent. It's not like in municipal law where you can bring a case before a judge and the respondent cannot escape so easily. In international law, you need two to tango. You need really
both states have to agree.
Yeah. But it may take different forms. It may take a declaration, a unilateral declaration, and for among all those who committed themselves, there is a link and there is a possibility to bring a case against each other. There is also the possibility of a clause in a treaty, compromissory clause. If you conclude a treaty on investment or amity or law of the sea, and in case of a dispute which would arise, you may bring the matter to a court, or there is a special agreement. It means after there is a dispute, both states may agree to submit the dispute to the court, which is not so easy, because once there is a dispute, there is always one party which is more inclined to bring the matter to a court. The declarations and compromissory clause are the best tools available to states.
You said earlier that the ICJ has contributed to peace and security throughout the years of its existence. Do you mean that in a general sense, or can you point to some specific examples where a resolution by the court made the difference between a non-violent and a violent end to a dispute?
Yes, indeed. I would say, for example, an obvious trivial example relates to delimitation of borders, maritime delimitation. There are plenty of cases like that. And currently, there are cases between, for example, Somalia, Kenya. You have also case between Nicaragua, Colombia, between Guyana, Venezuela, between Guatemala, Belize. And, you know, all cases, all disputes involving territories are very sensitive. And if you look at past history, very often it was a reason to wage a war, to engage into armed conflict. The world is in need of those tools as a peaceful settlement of dispute mechanism like the court. And it would diffuse tension. But you could have also, I take the recent decision in Jadhav case between India and Pakistan. It was concerning the consular right of an Indian citizen detained in Pakistan, accused of treason, and would be facing a death penalty. That's a very important tension. It may create tensions between states. And a case before the World Court would ease the job to a certain extent, would give a response, not necessarily with respect to the whole conflict, but would try to, at least not to aggravate, and give partial solutions.
Well, staying with borders, this obviously was a big preoccupation for you in your previous role. Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about maritime borders. Now, the big potential flashpoint is South China Sea right now. Are you concerned about potential rise in tension over the coming years in the South China Seas?
It's difficult to foresee in this respect, but what is visible is that with respect to some areas in the world, there is probably a need for mechanism to ensure peace and security. And when I refer to the consent-based jurisdiction of the court, for example, declarations by states involved or concerned in some disputes, maybe something to be considered by the states concerned in order to have a tool which could be activated in case there would be at a certain point some high tension. That's a procedural response to your question, I would say. But it's important because if there is no such confidence, there is no such consent given, it's difficult for a court to act. That would be my response. It's to encourage, to give a chance to a peaceful solution for such conflict. And through a special agreement, for example, states can also devise the precise dispute they want the court to adjudicate. They may avoid some aspects of the dispute they consider too political or too sensitive. And that's some learning process, but we need to encourage, and I'm sure the UN has a role to play in this respect.
Well, let's turn to your current role, registrar. Your term began this year. You have a 7-year term. Give us an overview of what your role entails.
Yeah, as a registrar, you are the head of the registry, which means simply a secretariat. The secretariat is there to assist the court composed of 15 judges, to deal with the job. It means to render judgment, orders, advisory opinions, and for that you need legal officers, you need interpreters, translators, because there are two official languages, English and French. You need also colleagues in charge of staff matters or financial matters to take care of the building. Because it's a small unit, but with different components, and as head of the registry, the registrar is active, I would say, in three main areas. First, judicial, because the registrar is the principal channel of communications with the parties, and will assist the president in planning, organizing the case. He or she will attend also the meetings of the court, the drafting committee, the different committees. The second area concerns administrative and budgetary matters. This, for example, last week I was on video link with the Fifth Committee to answer questions concerning the budget for 2020. And staff matters concern also an important area. And the third area, I would say, is the diplomatic functions. The registrar has to deal with states, international organizations, has also to publicize the work of the court. That's the main area. You mentioned 7 years for the term of office. My main objective is really to face the challenge, which is mainly the workload. 16 cases, it's unprecedented. I mean, it never happened like that in the history of the court, and it's since a couple of years, and it means we will probably get two more cases this year. This, it will grow.
You're essentially full up, aren't you?
Yes, it's full, but we are ready. And sure, if there are urgent measures to be taken, the court will take its responsibility, and therefore, sure, it will take 2-3 years to dispose of a case, but it will be dealt with. And but that entails a number of tasks, and my task is to make sure that we can deliver. But for that, and that means to have also a framework with staff members who can deliver, who have some trust regarding the leadership and the registrar. That's certainly a challenge, and to achieve that, to create a real teamwork, that's a clear objective, because the registrar cannot do alone. I mean, it's the head of a team. The budget, you need also to ensure that there is sufficient resource, and that's not easy in the current time. And also the building, there are some work on renovation works which have to be planned. There is also more midterm objective, like the 75th anniversary of the UN, and the court will follow. And on a personal tone, I would say, I know there is the New York Marathon on Sunday next year for the 75th anniversary. I think if there is a team of the UN, I will certainly participate.
Well, that's good to hear. We hope to have you back. Now, you mentioned that it's a very busy workload you have to deal with in terms of cases. Why has the number of cases gone up so much?
I would say there is a combination of factors. I mean, it's not just one element. Probably one key element is confidence in a court which has demonstrated its ability to deal with cases and which has elaborated a solid jurisprudence. And that's part of the attraction. I mean, if there is a court with solid, robust jurisprudence, which shows that there is some predictability. Because for states or for lawyers advising states, it's important to know that there are rules which are adhered to by the court and that there is a consistency in the jurisprudence. That's one element. Second element is also that, and that's very encouraging, it's to show that there is a need of a peaceful mechanism of settlement of dispute and that the court is has a really a useful role to play in a world which has not become easier. And there are a number of tensions, but it's natural. It has become natural to think of this option, not only negotiations, but the court as a tool, in order, a normal tool. It's not inamicable. It's not unfriendly. It's a tool in order to achieve a peaceful solution.
So you take this in a positive light, the fact that more states are using the ICJ as recourse for solving disputes.
I do. I think that's very positive.
Let's talk a little bit about advisory proceedings. You mentioned this is an important part of what you do. What do they achieve?
That's an important part of the job of the court, but just to put things in perspective, we have received so far 177 cases, and out of this figure, there are 27 requests for advisory opinions. That gives you things in the context. Advisory opinions are requested by the United Nations, General Assembly, or ECOSOC, or perhaps the Security Council, or by the specialized agencies of the UN, not by states. That's the big difference. Contentious proceedings, disputes, are submitted to the court by states only. For advisory opinion, it's by an international organization. That means there is a process. The General Assembly will submit a request and there will be a vote. It's the consequence of also negotiations. There is some legitimacy in the question which is submitted to the court. And there is a value, quite a high value given to advisory opinion in the jurisprudence of the court because it will clarify some rules. I give you an example. The legal personality of the UN. It's the result of an advisory opinion of the court in the early days. There is not a provision in the UN Charter recognizing the international legal personality of the UN. That was a contribution through an advisory opinion. UNAT, the UN Administrative Tribunal, the former UNAT. Its legality was challenged at a certain time in the 50s, and there was an advisory opinion of the court which underlines that it was legal for the General Assembly, lawful for the General Assembly to create this body in order to adjudicate between disputes between the organization and staff members. More recently, you had the latest advisory opinion on Chagos Archipelago, Chagos Island, and it was the process of decolonization from the UK and the separation of Chagos from Mauritius. And the question posed to the court by the General Assembly was to know whether this separation was lawful, was really in line with the applicable law with respect to decolonization at that time. And the response was affirmative from the court in the mid-60s. The self-determination rule was applicable. And it's an important contribution because it will guide the next process. Even if it's not binding, it has a very high value. Some people will say moral value, but it's a legal document even if it's not binding.
And finally, let's look ahead in the short term. The big cases that you're dealing with right now, could you outline two or three of them that you think are likely to be significant when the rulings come down?
Yes, indeed. Perhaps indeed, instead of giving a summary of the different cases, if you look at the whole set of 16 cases, It's important to see which are the matters concerned by those cases, because it gives you some indication on areas where there are questions in the international legal community. And for example, there are 5 out of 16 relating to delimitation disputes, borders, land boundary or maritime boundary. This is still, I wouldn't say bread and butter, but it's really something which is constant. And it's an important part. You have otherwise environmental cases, that's with the use of water between, for example, Chile and Bolivia. That's something which is also recurrent, environmental concerns. And it will come, I'm sure there will be more cases coming. There are cases relating to sanctions, countermeasures, and you may look at 2 cases between Iran and the U.S. Concerning the compatibility of those sanctions with respect to a bilateral treaty between the 2 states. You have also 2 cases against Qatar by a certain number of states from the Gulf relating to decision with respect to ICAO, International Civil Aviation Organization. Another area where there are cases regards violation of convention protecting human rights or consular convention. And there you have, for example, cases relating to the Convention Against Racial Discrimination, that's Qatar versus United Arab Emirates, but also Ukraine, Russia. And for the rest, you have cases involving immunity between states and reparation for liability incurred by a state in the aftermath of armed conflict, and that's the case between Congo and Uganda. And the last cases filed was between Palestine and United States. This, it gives you an overview of the areas where there are tensions, but I would say delimitation, environmental cases, use of force, sanctions, countermeasures are areas in which the court is very often called to adjudicate.
And it's not that often that we get to speak to senior members of the ICJ, so it's great to have you here during your time at UNHQ. If there's one thing that people could come away with when they think of the ICJ, what would you want that to be?
I mean, the peaceful settlement of dispute, it's a motto for me. That's really and confidence in the UN.
Philippe Gauthier, many thanks.